History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we'll simply ask a few questions and invest some time in listening. Our goal, first and foremost, is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we have experienced week after week for the last couple of decades, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And here we are, arriving at Memorial Day weekend, an annual reminder of a reality that we'd love to be kept in view 24/7, 365, that freedom is not free, and that so many through the years have paid the ultimate price. Before we go into some memories from World War II veterans, which will help us learn a little bit more about some of that conflict's Gold Star heroes, I want to remind you about the Stories Behind the Stars project. This is the perfect time for you to get involved. And if you have a student in your family who is on summer break or about to be on summer break, a wonderful opportunity to learn some history, to sharpen some research skills, and perhaps more than anything, pick up powerful perspective on just how great a price has been paid. Go to storiesbehindthestars.org and learn how you can be part of a grassroots effort to ensure that every single one of the more than 400,000 Americans who died while serving World War II is remembered by history as more than a name, more than a gold star on a memorial, but has a personal story to commemorate that supreme sacrifice. We're coming up on the 82nd anniversary of D-Day in the invasion of Normandy. In fact, next week, we're going to meet a 105-year-old veteran who witnessed the devastation on Omaha Beach firsthand. But D-Day is one of the sections now completed by the Stories Behind the Stars project. Every one of the 2,502 Americans who died that day has a personal tribute posted at storiesbehindthestars.org. But long before June 6, 1944 was seared into America's consciousness, December 7, 1941 was that date we were told would live in infamy and has. Stories Behind the Stars volunteers have now memorialized 2,341 who were killed in that surprise attack on Oahu. The USS Arizona Memorial is the number one destination at Pearl Harbor today, but not far away on Ford Island is a memorial to 429 who perished on the battleship USS Oklahoma. Years ago, we learned of one of them from one of the men who survived a day and a half trapped in that battleship's capsized hull. There's a postscript on the story of Darrell Artley's ultimate sacrifice that we're going to share in a moment, but we will have a much deeper perspective on the impact his life and memory had by listening to his brother Richard, or Swede as his friends called him, because the brothers from Maywood, Nebraska were both on the Oklahoma on that fateful day.
We had just come back from breakfast. We thought we had something that run into us when the first torpedo hit. But the Navy says they're absolutely positive that 8 torpedoes hit the Oklahoma, and very likely 10. I was in the steering room aft. I was just below the waterline. There were 8 of us in there. We had lights for about 10 minutes. Then the lights all went out. Of course, the ship turned over to port 151 degrees. Just a little bit of her bottom sticking out of the water.
And we've seen those famous pictures of the Oklahoma on December 7th. I have to ask, I haven't talked to anybody who was through what you were through on that day, to be trapped like you were. As those torpedoes are hitting, what did that feel like? What did that sound like? And did you have any idea where you were or what was going on?
Well, I knew where we were, but I didn't know that we had gotten into a war. We just tried to keep from getting hit by things flying through the air when the ship was turning over to port. And I didn't do a very good job because we had a guy named Woody Havens, was a heavyweight wrestler. He was a second-class quartermaster. He had all kinds of equipment down there, dumbbells and all that stuff, you know, to train on, and one of his dumbbells. I don't know why. I could never make myself understand what the heck I was doing in the telephone booth. But I had just stepped out, and one of his dumbbells came down and hit me in the leg.
Did it break your leg?
No, it didn't break it, but I had 13 bones in there that sprung loose.
So this is all happening on December 7th, 1941, as a nation is about to realize that it's at war, and you were realizing it before pretty much anyone else. I mean, the very first torpedoes were hitting your ship, would sink your ship, and you're trapped inside your ship as it's turning over. When did you realize that you were trapped, and what was going on inside that room? What kinds of things were being said? Set that scene for us if you can.
I didn't know we couldn't open any of the doors in the steered aft, but they were all locked from the other side. If I'd have known that, I would have gone nuts. And so we just, hell, I slept some of the time down there, and the water was still coming in. There was a fresh air blower coming into our room because it was hot down there. Oh, God, it was hot.
So these air vents are letting water in. You can't get out. So the room is filling more and more with water, less and less with air, and you guys are running out of time.
I think so. I talked to Jim Bounds one time, and I asked him, just a short time before he died, I asked him, I said, Jim, how much time do you think we had left down there before the compartment was completely full of water? He said, oh, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes would have done it.
And how long were you down there?
Well, we got out about 6 p.m. Monday night.
And this happened before 8 a.m. Sunday morning.
The ship had already been hit with all those torpedoes and already turned over. And they drilled holes wherever they had to get to us. We were very fortunate. We had two seamen on there. They'd gone to quartermaster school in the States before. They had just joined the ship about 2 weeks before the war started. And they knew Morse code. Somehow they got to talking to some of these people. And they finally told him, don't talk to us anyway, we know where you are and we're coming as fast as we can. When they did get down to us, they drilled these holes. They said, get ready to come out. When you get ready to take you out of here, just stiffen out. Because they had both sides of the places where they'd had those holes drilled. They just passed us out of the ship. And there was a Liberty boat down there, and one of the guys, George DeLong, he said, I was sure hoping I could go to Mass tonight. And this guy says, man, this is not Sunday night, this is Monday night.
You guys didn't even know how long you'd been down there.
I didn't have a clue.
You were trapped inside a sunken ship, running out of air to breathe, water filling up this hold. You were trapped in there for 34 hours.
That's right.
But you're talking about it like it's no big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, all right, because I knew if we didn't get out of there, we're done. Oh, I was scared. We all talked very positively. They'd get to us some way. Lieutenant Commander Hobby was the ship's first lieutenant. He kept talking to us, and we got down where we could talk to him verbally. We got our spirits up then, and we thought, now he's going to really get us out of here. By golly, they did.
When did you find out for sure that your brother was one of the casualties that day?
No one ever did come and tell me. I just had to accept that as I know Daryl didn't get through it.
Have you ever stopped and wondered what Daryl would have done with his life if it hadn't ended on December 7th, 1941?
Daryl was one hell of a baseball player, good pitcher. He was on the Oklahoma team, and I'm sure he would have gone into pitching in the big leagues sooner or later.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who didn't lose siblings in the war, but lost friends. And a lot of them felt like the life they led, that they couldn't take anything for granted. They had to stay positive and move forward, because if their friends had lived, that's what they would have done. Did you ever feel anything along those lines, feeling like you had to live in a way that would have honored your brother's sacrifice?
I tried to. Probably didn't do a very good job. I used to think about him all the time.
That interview with Richard Swede Artley was recorded less than 2 weeks before his passing in 2011. But I promised a postscript. And you may know that there's an ongoing effort, even today, to identify the Gold Star heroes of Pearl Harbor, since many of them were buried in a mass grave in Honolulu. In 2019, Daryl Artley's remains were identified, and in January of 2022, just over 80 years after Richard Artley's survival of that incredible ordeal on the Oklahoma was tempered by the news of his brother's passing, Daryl Artley was laid to rest in Vancouver, Washington, alongside his parents, with Daryl's niece, Linda, the daughter of the man we just heard from, receiving his flag at graveside military honors. So if you ever do have the chance to visit Pearl Harbor, take that bus from the visitor center to Ford Island, and amongst the 429 marble white pillars that make up the battleship USS Oklahoma Memorial, it won't take you long to find Daryl Artley's pillar and take a moment to honor and remember his ultimate sacrifice. Again, the goal of the Stories Behind the Stars project is to make sure every one of the more than 400,000 Americans who gave their lives in World War II is not only not forgotten, but has a story online that anyone can access anytime. Go to storiesbehindthestars.org to see what stories have been told and to volunteer to research some of those that haven't. If you know a Gold Star family, take some time this weekend to reach out to them to honor their family's sacrifice. It's time for our first break, but let me also throw out a reminder to research your own family's history. Could it be that a member of your family has given what President Lincoln famously called during the Civil War their last full measure of devotion? The existence of this program can be traced back to a Gold Star hero in my family tree. I've often talked about my World War II veteran grandfather, who inspired this privilege I've had for over 20 years of sitting down with veterans across the country and recording their stories. He earned a Silver Star in Europe for pulling 26 men out of burning tanks. But his inspiration to join the Army before Pearl Harbor was his uncle, one of our country's first military pilots in World War I, who was killed when his burning plane came down in France in October 1918. Vincent Duchek is my family's Gold Star hero, one of more than 116,000 Americans killed while serving in World War I. Still to come on this special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes, a man who took his very name from one of those who didn't come home from World War II, in a touching way, an ex-prisoner of war honored the men from his air crew who made the ultimate sacrifice. This special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Memorial Day edition of the program. I mentioned the Stories Behind the Stars project earlier, that effort to make sure every one of the more than 400,000 Americans who died in World War II has an accessible story to honor that sacrifice. And some of our interviews here could actually provide a head start for you if you decide to join that growing list of volunteers trying to bring that ambitious goal closer to completion. That includes the story of ex-prisoner of war Al Findlay, who spent his final years on the planet as a docent at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum in San Luis Obispo, California. You could visit there today and still find a plaque bearing Al's name on the wall. And bordering his plaque
On all four sides are plaques with the names of four members of his B-24 crew, all four Gold Star heroes.
Well, on the 26th mission, we'd been to the target had been Magdeburg. And we'd been to the target and bombed Magdeburg, and we were on a return trip. We were flying over the Ruhr Valley. We flew through a flak shield. I don't think it was there all the time. I think it must have just started about the time we got there.
Oof.
Anyway, we got hit at number one engine and set it on fire. We were hit in the rear part of the aircraft. So I got out of my position. Wasn't far to between the pilot and co-pilot. I think our interphone was out the same way, the reason I did that. The engineer got out of it. He flew the upper Martin turret, and he got out of the turret, and we were both standing by the pilot and the co-pilot, and the pilot said, "Bill, the engineer, go back to the rear and check the controls back there." He said, I can't control the airplane."
So maybe the cables to the rudder had been severed or damaged?
Yes.
Okay.
So Bill went back to the bomb bay and went back to the rear and gone a very short time, and he came back and said that the controls were cut. And also all three gunners had been wounded and in bad condition. And then he said, "I'm going to go back and take them." And I said, "Work over them, you know." And I said, "I'll go back with you too." And as I turned to go, the pilot grabbed my arm and said, "I'll start throwing everything over out of the bomb bay that you can. The flak suits, the flak helmets, even if you get your radios loose. But I can't hold the altitude." So I started doing that. And first thing I know, I look back up and the co-pilot was standing up, getting his parachute. And he said, "Bail out, bail out." So I grabbed my chute, and it was a chest chute, and hooked it on my chute. I took my GI boots that was beside me, and as I went out, I put them on the catwalk. Then I bailed out, and I left my shoes on the catwalk. But anyway, I was so low that we were so low that I saw two sheets come out after I would. I didn't see the airplane crash. I saw the airplane kind of climb and fall off, but I never did see it crash because when I hit the ground, I hit it so hard it knocked me out, and I was unconscious for I don't know how long laying there. And when I woke up, there were three German, I assume they were farmers, standing over me. Two of them had pitchforks, and the other one had a gun. Again, I was so kind of woozy, I didn't really know what was going on, you know. The one with the gun pointed at my head, you know, and I thought, "I bought the farm," you know. And then he turned the gun away and fired it, and then started laughing. And then I must have passed out again, because the next thing I knew, I was in a farmhouse. One of them was there, and a woman was there, and somebody had taken my wristwatch and my dog tags. They'd gone through my clothes, you know. I tried to ask how I got there, and they showed me a wheelbarrow. They'd put me in a wheelbarrow and rolled me in a wheelbarrow to where it was. It was after dark when somebody came back with the police and took us to the local jail. I say us, it took me to the local jail, but the others were in the jail. There were the co-pilot and the navigator and the nose gunner. The pilot wasn't there because they didn't see his chute open, and he was loose in the country for about 2 weeks before he turned himself in. But there was the nose gunner and myself, the co-pilot, and the navigator.
So that's four of you there at that jail.
There was five of them. Well, yeah, four of us. That's right. Because the pilot wasn't there. Okay, I'm trying to get five out of it.
Well, and the math, so everybody listening understands, you had nine men on the plane.
The bombardier wasn't flying then, because what they had done was take the nose gunner, and as the lead aircraft would drop their bombs, he would toggle the bomb. So we lost the bombardier, really.
So you've got a nine-man crew.
Yes.
And you talked about the three gunners in the back being wounded.
Yes.
They all went down with the plane?
They all went down with the plane, plus the engineer went down with the plane, and there was nothing wrong. He had gone, he was got caught back there.
He was back trying to help them.
That's right.
And it cost him his
life. So we don't. Nobody knows how bad they were injured or what was going on in the rear of the aircraft but Bill, the engineer, and he went down.
Did you guys know that at the time? That they had not survived?
Well, we'd known that they'd gone. We didn't know that, but assumed the airplane crashed. We didn't know they'd kill. We didn't know that till the Germans told us.
You mentioned how hard you hit the ground because you had to bail out at such low altitude.
Yes, yes.
You hit it so hard it knocked you unconscious. Did you have injuries as a result of that?
Just my back, the lower part of my back. It was hard. It was hard for me to sit down, so I hurt the lower part, tailbone or something.
But when you find yourself at this jail and you see some familiar faces, yes. That had to mean a lot to you to
That's
see them.
That's right, yes. My navigator, Rock Kramer, could understand a little German, but he didn't let him know that he understood German, you know. But anyway, he told us, he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg. He said, one of these fellows has got a mother or something that lives in where we just bombed, you know. Ooh. So he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg.
Yeah, and you can laugh about it now, yeah, but at the time, right. I'm sure there was a real fear that these people could kill you.
Yes, there was a real fear, yes. We spent one night in the jail, the local jail, and then the next afternoon, an officer, I think a lieutenant in the Luftwaffe, and a sergeant came to pick us up. He had a machine gun that he carried. They put us on a passenger train, and we went to Essen, which was a town in the Ruhr Valley. About the time we got there, the British were starting with bombing. So they took us off the train and took us down to the underground. A lot of civilians were there at that time, and they didn't care much for us. And they kind of started walking towards us, you know. The officer said something to the sergeant, and he pulled up his machine gun, and they backed away. But so it was just that way until the bombing was over, and then we went up, got back on the train, and it's very kind of vague now. I don't know, it took a day or 2 days to get to Oberursel, which is the interrogation center. I was in solitary confinement for 11 days, and the navigator was in solitary confinement for 13 days, and the other... Let's see, Smitty was a nose gunner, and they let him go early. The pilot wasn't there yet. He was still running around loose in the country. But I was there for 11 days, and then they put me on a boxcar on the train.
Before we hear about that,
okay,
11 days there in solitary with not a lot to eat or drink, probably not even that much room to stretch out in, I would imagine, huh?
I had a bucket for a toilet, and I had a straw mattress. Not much more in there, no.
And what about the actual interrogation? What kinds of things did they try to get out of you?
Well, it wasn't not what I thought, though. They wanted to know about the V-2 bombs, what the English were thinking of, you know, how much of a damage it's causing in England, actual damage, and then, you know, if it's the people are scared and stuff like that. Mm. But as far as military, I had very few questions about that because he knew more about my outfit than I did.
I've heard a lot of guys say that.
Yeah, he knew more my commanding officer's name, et cetera, et cetera. But they'd got it from previous people, I guess, you know. But most of my interrogation was not sensible questions. You know, they were just like they about the British, et cetera, et cetera. And do you think the war is going to be over soon, you know? My interrogator was a Captain Rubel.
And how was his English?
Good. Very excellent English, yes, yeah.
A lot of those interrogators they had spent a lot of time in the States.
Yeah, I bet. So, yeah.
Well, and you said they asked you, when do you think the war is going to be over? Again, I'm thinking about you. This is February 1945. You don't know that the war is going to be over in 3 months.
No, I don't know.
I mean, I imagine the future had to be a real uncertain thing for you at that point.
Well, it would have to be, yeah.
And how did you handle that? How did you deal with that reality that, hey, I may never get out of captivity or I may die in captivity?
I don't think that ever involved. I never thought of that, you know, because looking back, when we were hauling gasoline to Pat, they were moving so fast against the Germans. They're running, you know, in other words, their supplies couldn't keep up with them. So it wouldn't be too long, you know. We were told that not to try to escape because the war is going to be over pretty soon. So they took away our guns so we couldn't get in trouble. That just implied that, well, you know, it's not going to be long now.
That said, there was plenty of trouble for you in the months that followed, and even in the days. So you mentioned 11 days there at the interrogation center, and then they put you on another one of these 40 and 8s, packed in with a bunch of other POWs?
Yes.
How tightly were you packed?
You couldn't sit down. You had to stand. You had to stand. It wasn't too far to Wetzlar. And like I say, it was a transit camp because I'd been in my flying clothes for all this time, 11 or 12 days. I hadn't shaved. I hadn't showered. I was still wearing my flying boots. And so at Wetzlar, we got shower, shave, and change of clothes. I think maybe the Red Cross had something to do with it, you know. But I got boots and et cetera, and was there about, I guess I was there about 3 days. And then they put us back on the boxcars, again, crammed in like sardines. And we hadn't gone too far that day, and we got attacked by our own fighters, and they strafed the... We were just crammed in there, and...
So everyone understands, you're on this boxcar, and you know from a lot of your missions, a lot of the targets are railroads and marshalling logs,
oh, yes.
And they're trying to take out the supplies before they get to the front line. They don't know what's in these boxcars.
That's right, that's right.
So your own American planes are shooting the boxcar that you're in.
That's right, that's right.
And you saw people get hit.
Yes, 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 yes. I know there were several casualties, yeah. And the Germans finally opened the doors and let us out. And there was a forest right clumped of trees close to the track. And we were running for that. And the fighters saw that, I guess, and they stopped firing because they assumed it was either a troop train or carrying supplies or something, you know. It wasn't marked or anything. So they were probably shooting anything that moved in at that time.
Yeah. Boy, I can't imagine how scary that must be, how helpless a feeling that is.
You are helpless, yeah. You can't fight back. You can't do anything but run.
But you survived that.
Survived that. Then went to Nuremberg. And Nuremberg was just packed with prisoners. Just terrible. Had lice, bed bugs, roaches, all that stuff.
And what'd you have to eat?
Very, very, very little. Very little. I have a piece of German bread that tastes like sawdust. A soup invariably had little dead insects in it. That was about our food. Every once in a while, we would get some Red Cross parcels, but they'd puncture all the cans, so you had to eat them right away or let them spoil, you know. Mm. So they were pretty tricky on that. Nuremberg was another place that the British loved to bomb the Nuremberg, and our camp was very close to the town, and we would just bounce on them when they started bombing.
And what did your family know, if anything, about what had happened to you?
I don't think they knew anything, nothing.
Had you been reported missing? Did they get a telegram or anything?
Well, I didn't know at the time.
Right.
But later, they were told I was missing, and then when it was POW, they knew that I was a prisoner of war, yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes and how lonely and desperate and seemingly hopeless that scenario could be. I mean, you're on the other side of the world from your family. You've lost your freedom. You're not getting anything to eat. What was it that kept you going or kept your hope burning?
Well, a few prayers now and then I think didn't hurt, you know. You had somebody upstairs that was looking after you. So I felt pretty confident with that, you know. I'd always been somebody that I loved to go out fishing and camping and you know, live on my own, etc., like that. So I think a lot of that held over.
Your liberation didn't come there at the camp at Nuremberg. They had to move you because the lines were getting too close?
That's right, yes. We started on a march on leaving Nuremberg on the 4th of April in the afternoon. We hadn't gone too long, maybe 2 hours or something, and we were under a train trestle. And we got hit with three more American fighters. The first one strafed, and the second one started strafing and then stopped. And then the third one peeled off and didn't strike. So they must have recognized that we were POWs or something. Then after that, We had toilet paper, and we made a big sign out in a field, POW, you know. So, in other words, one plane saw that, because from then on, there was one plane that flew every day, would come and check on us, where we were, and et cetera. I'm glad they knew we were there and who we were.
I guess so, because otherwise there's nothing solid to hold on to. I mean, you don't know where you're going. You don't know how long it's going to take.
That's right. That's right.
You hadn't had much to eat. I have to think this was exhausting to be marching every day.
Yeah, and the weather was bad. It was raining, and it was really a bad trip. It took us about almost 2 weeks. I think we got to Mooseburg in about somewhere around the 20th of April, I think, a week before we were liberated. I felt kind of guilty all my life now since that I came so close. If it hadn't been for the pilot, I wouldn't be here. I came so close to going back there with Bill. I say it was a step away from death, you know.
So when Bill went back to help the wounded gunners, you were going to go with him, but pilot said you need to start jettisoning stuff and making this plane lighter.
That's right, that's right.
But if he hadn't said that, you would have gone.
I would have gone. I'd taken one step to go when he grabbed my hat. So I was that close to death.
And you would have gone down with the plane.
Sure, yeah. Everything happened so fast, you know. You didn't have really time to think, you know. Bill's gone back. Nobody knows how the three in the rear were, you other than he. He went back the first to check the cables, and he's found them wounded. And then he came forward and told us, and then we went right back again. And he was the only one on the crew that was married and had a child.
So when you say you felt guilty, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I think I hear you saying is that sometimes you wish you would have gone back and Bill would have survived.
So, yes.
And do you know, were their bodies ever found?
Yes, they were buried. I've got some German papers and stuff that they sent me. When it was all declassified, the Air Force sent it to me, and it covers a lot of the period I was over there, and it did say where the men were buried. You know, when the pilot came in to camp and we saw him again, he didn't really know that all of them had been killed, you know. And so that broke him up too, you know. And he said that he was going to put Bill in for a medal when he got back to the States, because he should have got the Medal of Honor, really, back there tending to them, and gave his life doing that, you know.
Yeah. When you say you felt guilty about Bill, I'm wondering if you talk about the wonderful life you've had. Have you had a sense of trying to make the most of your life in light of what happened to Bill and those other three?
I think so. Like I say, I've had a guilty feeling ever since that happened. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I just couldn't get rid of it, you know. And I think when I got those plaques, I had a plaque put up on the wall about 2 years ago.
And we're talking right here where we're sitting at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum. So there's a wall near the entrance with all these plaques that list the names of different servicemen. So you had your name put up there.
I had my name put up and my service up, yes.
So that'll be here long after you're gone.
That's right, that's right.
But then you had another idea.
Yes, I did. I decided that to get plaques for each one of those and have them positioned where each one touched my plaque, and that we would be back together again after 70-some years. And that's happened, and I think big relief has been taken off of my shoulders for doing that.
That's not free. That costs some money to do that.
That's beside the point.
Well, that is my point.
Okay.
Because what you got from doing that, from honoring those guys from your crew who aren't here anymore, sounds like that satisfaction and that maybe closure that you developed from that is priceless.
I do feel that way, yes.
Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story. I'm pretty sure that Bill and those other three fallen brothers of yours would be really proud of what you're doing.
I hope so.
He no longer has to hope. Al Findlay passed away in 2019, and now he knows so. If you ever have the chance to visit the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum, look for those four names around his on the wall. Bill Fowler, Raleigh Murray, Theodore Mabee, and John Gates. Four Gold Star heroes we honor this Memorial Day, and four whom Al honored every day. This special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, taking the time along with all of America this weekend to honor those who have paid the ultimate price for our freedom. For the Vietnam War, that number is more than 58,000. And if you ask a Vietnam veteran, you'll likely hear that that number should really be multiple times that. When you consider the life-shortening effect of Agent Orange exposure, which has had a significant impact on so many who did make it home. If you visit the Korean War Memorial in Washington, D.C., you will find more than 36,000 names etched in stone. But not far away at the National World War II Memorial, above a notation proclaiming, "Here we mark the price of freedom," rest 4,000 gold stars, each one representing more than 100 Americans in World War II who didn't get to come home. Again, go to storiesbehindthestars.org to volunteer to add stories, faces, and names to those stars so history never forgets those men and women. And the next story we get to hear reflects a powerful way one World War II vet got to honor a shipmate of his who was killed 81 years ago this week on May 28, 1945. By the end of this little snippet from our interview with Leonard Blake, I think it's going to become crystal clear. Orphaned as an infant, adopted by an LAPD officer who later abandoned the family, Leonard started trying to join the war effort when he was only 14. And about a year and a half later, he finally got his wish.
I saw a sign that said, "Join the United States Maritime Service. Serve your country." It was on 6th and Hill Street. And I went into the recruiting office and he said, "Let me see your birth certificate." I said, "Well, here I go again," because I was only 15 years old, and he had to be 16 and a half for the maritime school. And he took my birth certificate, and he looked at it, and he said, "Yep, you're 16 and a half, just like that. I was 15. So that's when I got in the United States Maritime Service.
Did you know how dangerous that job could be?
Not really. I just wanted to get into the war effort. I was a hot shell man on a 3-inch 50 forward on the Marianne Livermore.
But that wasn't your first ship.
No.
That wasn't your first ship.
My first ship was the SS John Constantine. I made mistakes all the way along. When we pulled into New York Harbor, after we were the only ship that made it, we had three ships leave San Pedro, and they were loaded with 2,700 ton of bombs on each one of them. And we were the only ship that got through to Calcutta with our bomb load.
What happened to the others?
They got sunk. We were the only ship that made it.
Now, when you say that, does that mean you witnessed that? You saw them sinking?
No, I saw the... Well, I was on bow watch one night, and I saw a flash of light just completely light up the sky. We were one day apart. Three ships that were one day apart as we left. And I saw the sky light up, and I knew it was one of the ships.
Hmm.
But then I'd heard afterwards that the other one had gone to, we were in Australia, and from there we were over to India. And,
well, when you see that flash of light, now, and as I understand it, you're three ships, one day apart, but following the same course to India. So you see that flash of light, you put two and two together, you know what's happening.
Yeah, we know.
And you guys are going to be passing through those same waters.
Yeah.
Does that make you wonder what's going to happen to you?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, you're waiting for them.
Did anybody on the ship know how young you really were?
I don't think so. Because the captain on the first ship I was on, he and the first mate called me in when we reached New York Harbor. And wanted me to go to officer's training school, and I was only 16. I said, no, Captain, I want to go to sea. So that's when I got off that ship and went over to the Marianne Livermore. And when I got back down to, you know, San Pedro, that was my last ship.
Did anybody on the ship know how young you really were?
I don't think so. Because the captain on the first ship I was on, he and the first mate called me in when we reached New York Harbor and wanted me to go to officer's training school. And I was only 16. I said, no, Captain, I want to go to sea. So that's when I got off that ship and went over to the Marianne Livermore. They told me that I'd never walk again when I got wounded. I shattered both bones and both legs. And I had, doctor said I had so many wounds I couldn't close all of them. The field surgeon, he said, we've got to take your legs off, son. And I said, no. You just roll me over there and let me die because I don't want to lose my legs. He thought a minute. He said, we'll see what we can do. And he promised that he wouldn't take my legs off. They put me to sleep, and I woke up, and I had casts on up to here all the way down my legs, and my wounds were all somewhat sealed up. He asked me, how am I doing? And I said, I worked in a hospital one time, I said, when I was 13, I think. And I said, I never saw red casts before. And he laughed, and he said, you had so many wounds, we couldn't close all of them. 9 surgeons worked on me from Okinawa back all the way to the United States. And every one of them told me I'd never walk again. And I asked to get out of the hospital, and the doctor said, if you can get on crutches, I'll let you go. Because the Blakes came to see me, and their son was one of the boys killed on the ship. They wanted me to come and live with them. And I told them, like, if I can get out of the hospital, I'll come live with you. Finally, the doctor let me go. I had got the crutches, and I got it. One of the nurses took me to the train station, sent me back, and I went to live with the Blakes. They took me in, and they were like a mother and father to me. And they finally adopted me. Yeah, I was in my forecastle at the time the plane hit us. And the armor-piercing bomb came through below decks and killed the captain and the first mate and landed next to me and exploded.
Well, and even before that, had you guys dealt with kamikazes there at Okinawa?
Yeah, we were there for 20 days.
So,
and they'd come in every day. The kamikazes would come in, and they'd be hitting the ships and skipping off the water when they'd blow them up.
So you'd seen all this with your own eyes.
Uh-huh.
Did you think it was going to happen to your ship?
Well, there was always that chance.
Mm-hmm.
And we always thought we got to our gun station as quickly as we could, you know. On this one, I was down in my forecastle. I heard the plane hit. Then the bomb, when it got to me, I was on my feet. I was headed for the door, and the bomb exploded about 10 feet away from me, I guess, and killed the kid next to me. Blew me through the door into the passageway and my head first into the bulkhead. This top of my head is like a road map where I hit the bulkhead. And I woke up in a passageway sitting there in a pool of blood. And I couldn't figure out what the heck happened. I thought I was dying. I started making promises. I said, if you let me live, I'll never, and I couldn't think of anything I'd ever done because I never smoked or drank. And I made the promise that I'd never smoke or drink. And I just went from there on.
And as you described that, how close the bomb landed to you, what happened to others who were there?
It killed a kid next to me, and 11 were killed from the bomb blast and from the plane hitting the topside. 11 dead, 7 were wounded.
And it sounds almost impossible that you did survive.
Yeah.
Did you lose consciousness?
When I hit the bulkhead, I was out, yeah. It blew me through there was an escape panel on the door panel, and I was just a few feet from the door and to get into the passageway so I could get to my gun station. When it blew me through it, well, I went head first right into the bulkhead on the other side, and it put me out. I woke up sitting there looking, and I was in a pool of blood, and my legs were hanging there.
Your pants had been blown off.
That's all. I didn't have a shirt on.
And so you're taking stock of your injuries.
Yeah, I was looking at them.
So your legs, you couldn't control, and the muscles were detached?
They were all torn up. The calf muscle was hanging out and jumping around. And and blew off a portion of this foot, my left foot, and then my right foot had a great big hole on the top of my foot, and my Achilles tendon was severed, and I had all wounds everywhere. I had one I had right here in my chest, and I remember reaching down. It was a piece of metal sticking in me here, and I reached down, and I pulled it out and dropped it on the deck.
Right from the center of your chest?
Yeah.
And your eye socket was broken, too?
Yeah, yeah, the socket on this side is busted here, and I don't know what was done on top, because they didn't even pay any attention to my head when I got to the field hospital. When they took me off the ship, they put me in a longboat and took me over to another ship, and then put me back on the ship again, or on the longboat, and I was on the boat with the ensign that was in charge of the gun crew on my ship, and he was lying there next to me, and he was crying and apologizing. He says, "I thought it was a kingfisher. I ordered the gun crew not to fire." And I said, "Don't blame yourself for it. That's just something that could happen to everybody." But he was all upset about it.
Because he had thought this is an American plane.
Yeah.
But it turns out it's a Japanese kamikaze.
Yeah.
And your body is shattered.
Yeah, everything. I had wounds everywhere. They said I had so many wounds I couldn't close all of them.
And you must have lost a ton of blood.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. They were pumping blood into me all the time.
So what were you really thinking? As I try to put myself in your shoes, it's hard to imagine that you could see much of a future for yourself in that condition.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you just think, oh, this is, the end. But you just keep going.
And you mentioned that 11 of your shipmates were killed.
Yeah, and I made a promise to them. I promised them that I'd give them 10 years of my life, each one of them. I don't know how old I'd be, probably 110. But I keep thinking now, with this thing here, the way things are, and my heart's going on me and everything. And I look up and I see them. I said, "You're keeping me here because I made that dumb promise when I was a kid."
Well, let me ask you about that, too. Because I've talked to a lot of veterans who made promises like that.
Yeah.
And some of them, it was something that came from a real deep-rooted place that they really believed someone was listening when they made that promise. And others, it was a desperate, plea to someone they weren't sure was there or not. Yeah. What about for you? Is that something that you really felt deeply someone was listening to you?
Yeah. I never believed in God or anything before. But all of a sudden, somebody was there. And I was thanking them for letting me live. And my promises I made.
And those guys who were killed?
Yeah.
How many of them did you know well?
Probably half of them. Some of the Navy kids were around with them, and the kids in the Merchant Marine, I knew them. Bob Blake was one, and T.J. Garner was another. He was the one that was next to me. He was laying next to me on his bunk. I was sitting there in this pool of blood, and I looked over, and here comes Garner through the escape hatch. He's crawling through like this, and he's reaching out to me, and I'm thinking, I can't help him. And he was trying, just like asking for help. And I looked over at him, and he fell forward, and he had a hole in his back about that big.
6 inches or so.
Yeah, and he was dead. But
wow.
It's hard for a 16-year-old kid to go through that.
Boy, it seems impossible for a 16-year-old kid to go through that.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Bob Blake, and it sounds like there was a pretty special connection the two of you had.
Yeah, we were buddies, His mom and dad were, he was an only son, too. And so when I didn't have any place to go from the hospital, because the little lady that was my mother at the time, she was being taken care of by relatives. So I had no place to go. And the Blakes took me in.
So Bob Blake, you two were very tight. His family took you in afterwards. But what happened to him that day aboard your ship?
He was killed.
Where was he when it
hit? He was on the gun watch. He was on the 20-millimeter up on topside, and the plane killed him.
And when did you find that out, what had happened to him?
Right afterwards.
Right after you were hurt?
Yeah, I was told by the doctor that, there was 11 that were killed on my ship.
What date was that this happened?
May 28th, 1945. And that's the date I was discharged from the Coast Guard. And then my discharge from the United States Maritime Service was in 1946.
So you're 16 years old.
Yeah.
By any realistic expectation, the injuries you suffered could have or should have been enough to kill you.
Yeah, they would have been.
Your best friend is killed.
Yeah.
And several other of the guys that you'd been spending time with are killed.
Yeah.
What does that do to a 16-year-old's heart and soul and mind?
You just dream about them every night, every day. I still, to this day, I still think of my shipmates. And they said I didn't want anything from the government at all, but they took the veteran status away from us and the GI Bill and everything. You didn't have anything. And in 1988, I found out that they did. They had rectified it, and they were veterans finally. I weighed 160 when I was wounded, and I weighed 90 pounds when I left the hospital.
What did you have to do to get out of the hospital?
I begged the doctor to let me go. He said, I'll let you go if you can get on crutches. And I said, give me the crutches. And I got the crutches, and they finally let me go. And one of the nurses took me to this train station, and I came back to Southern California to the Blakes, and they took me in.
So this is, you know, the family of your best friend who's killed the day you're almost killed.
Yeah.
And they visit you in the hospital, and they say, we want to adopt you.
Yeah.
How big a difference did that make in your life?
I don't know. I just, they were the nicest people in the world, and I always thought about Bob. I owed it to him.
Bob Blake, one of more than 400,000 Gold Star heroes from World War II, as remembered by his shipmate, who was later adopted by that very Gold Star family. What a reminder to all of us that we can carry the spirit of Memorial Day with us throughout the year, that we can live in a way that assigns a value to our freedom that might come a little closer to the price that has been paid. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, wishing you and yours the most meaningful of Memorial Days, and saying it one more time for emphasis, because after all, this is how we close out the program each and every week. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.